You're at, oh, and there's Kelly. All right, Linda, you now have exactly a quorum.
Okay. With that in mind, I will begin. Call us to order. Robert, if you will help Bruce with his sandwich, do a roll call. Let's see who's here. Let's make this official.
All right. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
All right.
All right. So, let me go ahead and start a roll call then. Robert Ballard.
Here.
Denise Bauer.
Here.
Lorna Brooks.
Here.
Janice Bryson.
Here.
Colleen Byron.
Here.
Kelly Corsett.
Here.
Boy Coy. Doesn't look like he's here.
No, he's not, Robert.
Tom Foster.
I'm here.
Bruce Gwynn. Not here either.
No, he's here.
No, Bruce is there. Bruce is there.
Okay, oh, hey, okay. Sharon Hollenbeck.
Here.
John Lacey.
No, he's off the board. He has fulfilled his tenure. He's off the board.
All right. Tom Rose.
Here.
Greg Scott.
Here.
Jim Snitzer.
Here.
Michael Wade.
Here.
Linda Whitaker.
Here.
All right.
Okay. As a courtesy to our guests, we are very pleased to have Scott Reinhart and Dale Chapman here. We have talked to them a couple times over the past 6 months or so, and our discussions have been very productive and illuminating. So we asked them here today to review our Sunset findings and where we stand currently, and we'll open it up to Q&A after they're done. I think it's a formal presentation with a PowerPoint.
Linda, I have to do a little housekeeping. We have a little bit of an embarrassing situation.
Right.
We don't know which staff member started the meeting. So whoever did that, assign me as the host, and I will take care of the rest.
Over to you, Jim.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Dot, I'm now giving you and Dale authority to share your screens, and you should be able to do your presentation.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Dot Reinhart. I have my video on, but I'm going to turn it off, and I'm going to share a PowerPoint presentation with you. But I wanted you to see my face before I turn
myself off. Hey, Dot, can you do something with your audio? Can you increase the volume?
Let me try talking louder.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm using my headset because there's a lot of noise in the neighborhood today, so I'm trying to hopefully clear out some of that noise.
Yeah, you're coming through loud and clear. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. All right, so I'm going to start sharing my screen, and I'll go through a presentation. And as has been said, you know, if you have questions along the way, just let me know. Okay, so just checking to make sure you can see my screen.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Perfect. Okay, so as I stated just a minute ago, my name is Dot Reinhart, and I'm with the Auditor General's office. So on this screen, I'm summarizing what we plan to cover today, including background information, about our office, a brief overview of our prior sunset review and the follow-up, and then I'll provide you some information related to the society's upcoming sunset review.
Excellent.
Okay. So the Auditor General's Office is a legislative agency that is overseen by the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, or JLAC, as we like to refer to them. We serve as an independent source of impartial information concerning state agencies and governmental entities, and we provide specific recommendations to improve those entities. And our office has audit responsibilities for state agencies, counties, universities, community colleges, and school districts. So in 2013, we conducted a sunset review of the society. We had two primary findings. The first focused on additional steps needed to address declining revenues, and the second focused on collections management issues. Our first finding centered on operational risks the society faced because of declining revenues during fiscal years 2008 through 2012. This finding focused on three key areas as shown on this slide, and over the next additional slides, I'm going to provide more detailed information about each of those areas. So in the first area, we reported on steps that the society was taking to address declining revenues, such as establishing a nonprofit corporation to act as a fundraising arm for the society, and taking steps to reduce operating costs. However, we found that more actions were needed, so one of our key recommendations was to develop an aggressive fundraising plan with specific action steps. In addition, because fundraising was so important, we recommended that the society, as resources allow, establish a development officer position to oversee its fundraising activities. At our 2015 24-month follow-up, so that was the last follow-up we did for the society, the society had established a fundraising plan. However, instead of establishing a specific fundraising position, the society had placed that responsibility with its central division director, who was tasked with spending 15% of their time planning, directing, and managing fundraising activities. In the second area, we provided information on the society's regional chapters. So as shown on the screen, at the time of our audit, there were five. Statute allows the authority to establish regional chapters. These chapters consist of society members who have a common interest regarding Arizona history in a geographical area of the state. Chapters are advisory in nature, but they may have other responsibilities, such as encouraging membership, assisting with society fundraising, and recommending names of individuals from the chapter to serve on the board. This map also shows the museum visitation and artifacts at the time of our review. We found that the society needed to decide whether the regional chapters were necessary. At the time of the audit, the society was providing a portion of its membership monies to these chapters, but during fiscal years 2008 through 2012, these chapters didn't raise any money for the society, even though they had fundraising responsibilities. In addition, we found that the regional chapters had autonomy over how their monies were spent, and their priorities may have differed from the society, such as wanting to support a project only in their region versus a statewide priority that was determined by the society. In addition, the regional chapters had, so we looked at nine Western states that had similar agencies. as the Historical Society, and at that time found that none of those states had regional chapters. So I'm seeing that there are people in the waiting room. Do I need to do anything on that?
No.
No, I'll let them in.
Okay, perfect. All right. So we recommended that the board review and determine whether its chapters had a continuing role, and if not, eliminate them. And also, if the chapters were continued, we recommended that the board review, revise, and clearly define the chapter's roles. For example, clearly defining the chapter's fundraising responsibilities and expectations. At our 24-month follow-up, again, that occurred in December 2015, the board minutes indicated that it would continue the chapters. However, we didn't receive any documentation to show that the board had reviewed, revised, or more clearly defined the chapter's roles and responsibilities. Our third and final focus area for finding one was on the society support groups. So at the time of the audit, as shown on the screen, there were 8 support groups. These groups, which are different than the regional chapters, were established as nonprofit tax-exempt agencies to benefit the society. However, we found that the board needed to strengthen its fundraising relationships with these private support groups, and the society was not requesting financial statements or other documents, and so it was not aware of the monies that these groups might have available to assist the society. In addition, the society was not verifying that these groups were in good standing with the Arizona Corporation Commission, which is required for these groups to continue and to participate in activities such as fundraising on behalf of the society. So we recommended, consistent with national and state museum standards, that the society enter into written agreements with these support groups to define roles, expectations, and authority. At our 24-month follow-up, we found that the society had entered into written agreements with these support groups. So then our second finding, we reported that there were critical collection management issues that had not been fully addressed, and these included environmental issues, insufficient storage space, and inconsistent tracking and or inventory issues. Several of these issues had existed in prior sunset reviews that we had completed in 1995 and 1998. So we had several recommendations in finding two, including developing and implementing a collections management plan and manual, and strengthening controls over collections, including ensuring all items were cataloged, creating a single statewide listing of collections, and completing a physical inventory that was in line with industry standards. In addition, we recommended that the board enhance its oversight of the society's efforts to address its collection management issues and needs. At our 24-month follow-up, we found that the society was in various stages of implementation. For example, the plan and manual had been implemented, but the inventory or cataloging of collections was still in process. In addition, although the society's efforts to address collection management issues were being shared or reported to a subcommittee, it wasn't clear that the information was actually getting to the full board. Okay, so that was our last sunset review, and so now I want to spend some time discussing the upcoming sunset review process. So as you may be aware, the society is scheduled to terminate on July 1, 2024, unless continued. To determine whether this society should continue, and if so, for how long, the society must undergo another sunset review prior to its termination. So back in December 2020, the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, or JLAC, assigned the Society to conduct a self-review for the House Government and the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committees of Reference. So the self-review process involves a few steps. So sometime this month, you should expect to receive an email notification from our office about the assignment to a self-review. Then the Corps will contact the Society in early spring or summer 2023, so that's a couple years away, and explain the questions you need to answer as a part of this self-review, self-sunset review. And the questions would include the same types of questions that the Auditor General spends answering on a sunset review, and those are the statutory sunset factors. So those factors focus on items such as the Society's statutory objective and purpose, whether the Society has met those objectives, and whether termination would significantly affect public health, safety, or welfare. So the Society will be responsible for gathering the information needed to respond to the statutory questions, and sometimes the Corps will require additional questions be answered, and those reports are typically due September 1st, so in your case it would be September of 2023. And then during the fall of 2023, or by the third Friday in January of 2024, there will be one joint or two separate core hearings to discuss the sunset review of the society and make determination on the Society's continuation. And those hearings are open to the public. Okay, so that concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions, and Dale Chapman is also here as well.
This is Tom Rose. I did have a couple of questions. It might help clarify some of this information that you presented to us. You had some issues with regional chapters. We've been working on that to clarify the roles. The issue of the chapter funds that have been listed previously as 1107s, recommendations on those, and having chapter full control. Our bylaws aren't really clear as to what that is, or that that is a fact. It just says that the chapters will decide what they need done in their areas with that chapter fund money. It's been characteristically used in the Northern Division as it becomes available to better the operations. A lot of the things that we look at and that I noticed in your presentation are dependent on fundraising. And one question I was looking at, since we didn't have chapters in 9 states, how many of those 9 states are fully funded by the state, or are they set up similar to the Arizona Historical Society as a society with partial state funding and a duty to fund themselves? Any information you can provide me in that direction? If we're going to model on one of the other states as to chapters or not having chapters, the chapters do need to provide funding. Several do provide funding.
So at the time of our review, I don't, you know, I don't remember how they were set up. I do know that the states that we looked at did have performed similar functions, such mm-hmm. as the society did, but I don't recall the funding structure of those states. But none of those states, as indicated in our report, did have regional chapters.
Okay. And I noticed that James has some of that information for me, so I won't bother you with it anymore. One other question on that is, or comment, is that according to laws of the state of Arizona that created the Historical Society, the chapters are a necessity if we are to set up regions. That's part of the chapter duty, is to provide a board member from the chapter zone, and that's in the state state law as stated as such. If we change and abandon chapters, won't the state have to change that portion of the law?
No,
41821.
I do know that state law allows for the establishment of chapters, but I'm not. I don't know that it.
But it provides. It provides
anything about funding.
It's not regarding funding, but just the existence of chapters, and the existence of chapters is designated in the state by a law, in the law, the 41821 or whichever one it is. I don't have it handy here.
I believe it's regional zones, not chapter zones. So
yes, it is regional.
But they have regional zones that are not dependent on having chapters.
My understanding, Tom, is that the wording allows for chapters.
That's a bylaw.
Pardon me?
That's the bylaws in the state law. It specifies that there will be a representative from each chapter and from each county and five from at large. So it's in that particular section.
The law describes historical organizations.
Right.
And for the purpose of getting board members on the board from chapters, they've included it there, but in truth, that is a very broad definition. And
right.
It is not solely limited to chapters, but it could include certified museums and other kind of museums affiliated with us.
I could add something.
I said one member from each designated historical organization.
I'd like to just add something because I chaired the transition committee.
Yes.
When we went from the member appointed to the governor appointed board, and the meaning of those what designated historical organization was a very important question at the time. In the legislative, in the minutes of the legislative hearings, it was clear that the legislature meant chapters. And the interpretation is reinforced by the fact that they gave five seats and, you know, representing five chapters. And the governor's office, when we met with them to make sure there wasn't a difference between their view and the state legislature, the governor's office agreed that meant chapters.
Mm-hmm.
Another reason for the existence of the chapters is that when we went to the governor-appointed board, and we heard this a great deal in that time period, one of the big concerns was that in the old system of member-appointed board, the rural counties, rural Arizona, had been neglected. There was far too much attention being paid to Phoenix and Tucson, and even on occasion Flagstaff. And in fact, under the old member-appointed board, there was proportional representation, and the Maricopa County and Pima County and Coconino County had more members on the board than other counties. So the legislators that were pushing this change, you'll notice it was very egalitarian. Each county got the same member, you know, number of members on the board. Then you had your at-large members. Then you had your chapter representative. So I believe it is crystal clear, because this was hammered in at the time, that they meant chapters. And they were concerned very much about geographical representation. And they were also, for want of a better term, upset at the thought that the large urban areas were getting all of the attention, and you had large areas of Arizona that were not being represented. And I remember, because we went through a lot of work at the time, one of the big points that was made was, when you bring in your new slate of people for that board, you better have someone from every one of those counties. We don't want anyone left out. And so overall, every bit of evidence I see was, not only did they mean the chapters to be the designated historical organizations, but they saw the value of the chapters. And I think there are going to be some things we're going to get into later. I don't want to get ahead of the agenda on this, but I think the chapters are potentially very valuable. I think they're valuable right now, but I think they have a potential value that can make a huge difference with regard to the health of the Historical Society.
Could we go back to Dot or Dale? There's been some discussion of this board that recommendations by a Sunset Review, and it has been said as suggestions. And would you please clarify your recommendations in terms of what risk do you take if you don't act on these? Just talk me through it. First, are your recommendations merely suggestions, and are they optional?
So, Madam Chair, this is Del Chan, and I'll jump in on this. They are recommendations. Our office does not have authority to require agencies to implement the recommendations. However, having said that, the legislature has that authority, and there's been instances in the past where the legislature has either requested or required agencies to take action to implement recommendations. Where there has not been sufficient progress, or there's been the agency has had a different mindset or opinion as far as taking action to address recommendations. So when we conduct our follow-up work, we do work to assess agency efforts to implement the recommendations. We report out on the status and those efforts, and we report out to the legislature, including the chairs of our JLOC committee, as well as the chairs of an agency standing committee, so that those legislators are aware of the agency's efforts to implement the recommendations, and then the authority would rest with them if they wanted to follow up on anything.
I think have this material. I'm not going to ask you to respond to it now, but you have an update on where we stand on a number of these issues. You do have in your possession our policy regarding bylaws. This was approved by the board in May of 2019, and you have a copy of that. Maybe at a later date, what I'm curious about, what I'm hopeful for, is that it adequately describes the roles of chapters that will satisfy that gap, if you will, in what you've been provided before. So we have, that this board has acted on that, has drafted and approved that role description. And I'm going to be eager to find out if we need to continue to work on that or if that's sufficient. So just so you know that you have the latest updates of where we stand on that. If I may, I would like to go back to the 1107 fund. And maybe Jim Snitzer can weigh in on this as well. There are a lot of things that around 1107 funds, it is on the agenda today to eliminate them, but it also eliminates the chapter's responsibility to do fundraising. Doesn't hold into that. So it's quite specific in terms of and the time frame in which to spend that down, et cetera. That comes up later today. But you should know that that's up for a vote, a formal vote here. Jim, do you have anything else to say about 1107 funds as it pertains to helping the budget? Unmute. Unmute.
Thank you, Sharon.
Here we go. I thought I could unmute just by hitting my space bar, but that didn't work. On the 1107 funds, we've got a recommendation to bring to the board to eliminate the funds. We were just talking about the narrow issue of the funds. And the finance guys, in my view, should not be talking a lot more about the issue than just the financial aspects of it. It's for the entire board to look at the other aspects of it. But I would say that, to me, an audit comment is, suggestion is a pretty word for the way I take it. I take it as, Moses came down from the mountain with 10 suggestions, that was about the same level of import to me. And so, all I can suggest, I feel strongly about the 1107 funds. I think it's not in anybody's interest to continue for a lot of reasons. And that was the view of the Finance Committee and the Executive Committee. With respect to continuing the chapters, as a finance guy, all I can suggest is if this was a financial issue, I would say step back and do what they call zero-based budgeting. Ignore the fact that we have chapters today. And just say, given the need today to have representation on the board of 5 people from historic organizations throughout the state, how would we choose to fill that need? And if a way we would choose to fill that need is with chapters, or anybody, if the way to fulfill it is not through chapters, we need to do a very good job of laying down our expectations. But again, that's from a finance guy, that I've already said more than I probably should. Okay.
Next.
Okay. I was just going to weigh in on that as well. I have a contrary opinion to Jim Snitzer on the 1107 funds. The issue there is that those are covered under both bylaws and policy. So no action can be taken today on either of these without a bylaw and a policy change. And those two require a 30-day notification prior to the action and a 10-day notification prior to action for policy. 1107 funds, I think, are a good way for the chapters to be funded in some of their projects and to actually spread out some of the funds that come into this state organization. Historically, they were never or very seldom distributed, and most of the chapters didn't even know they had them. And that, when I started 7 years ago, 1107 funds were not even a part of our consideration up here for funding. Even if we asked for funding to do something, it was pretty much bypassed. I think it gives the chapters an opportunity to input on what's needed in their areas. Historically, we haven't had a very functioning maintenance and improvement program, which is being remedied at the present. I think that the further discussion of those two items are needed, but in regards to the sunset audit, a clarified definition in the bylaws and the policy manual, I think, would be a proper solution to some of the sunset audit issues. Would that be, would something of that nature satisfy sunset audit? This I would direct to Dot or Dale. Would our revising bylaws and policy manual to further clarify a chapter of relevancy, duties, and control and expenditure of funds. Would those satisfy the governor?
Madam Chair, Mr. Rose, doing so sounds like it would be consistent with the recommendation we made that if the society or the board determines to continue the chapters or keep the chapters. We recommended that the society look at the chapter's roles and responsibilities and clarify those as needed. So that was a recommendation we made at the time of our final follow-up, which was in December 2015. Mm-hmm. The board and the society had yet to implement that recommendation.
Yeah, thank you.
Linda, one comment, and thank Tom and thank everybody. I don't understand the parliamentary rules, but we did announce at the last board meeting that we were going to bring a recommendation to this board meeting to discontinue the funding. So we haven't. This is not something bringing in everybody at the last minute. We did try and signal that this was an issue that would have to come before the board at this meeting.
We can vote on something that impacts portions of the policy, and we have more than a 10-day notice. We might have something backwards here. Do you change a policy before you even acted on something? Usually that's modified after the fact. So we will have a vote today on 1107 funds, but not a vote on chapter rolls because I think there's a lot more to be discussed here. And like I said, it has been reviewed and updated by this board on 2019. That may be sufficient to keep chapters. I don't know. We'll see how AG's office and others weigh in on that. I have a quick question about the CORS entity, that group. Who sits on that? And is that based on a legislative assignment? Does that change every year?
I can speak to that. So the CORS are made up. So the committee of reference, there is one in the House and one in the Senate that have been assigned to kind of oversee the sunset review process for this upcoming review that you are responsible for. And they're made up of 10 members, so 10 House members and 10 Senate members. And the membership can change. So as legislative members end terms and new members come in and a new legislative session is started, new members can be assigned to those committees. I would be able to send you assignments for 2021, so I could tell you who the members are in 2021 for the two committees, the House Government Committee and the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee that you have been assigned to, but they could change in the future.
Who would chair that automatically? The senior most person from each House or House or Senate?
I believe that the members choose their chairs. Dale, I don't know if you know specifically on that.
Meaning the chairs of the committee? Yeah, the chairs of the committee are typically, or the committee of reference are typically the chairs of the, either the chairs or sometimes the vice chairs of the assigned committee. And so, to add a couple thoughts to what Dot shared, she's correct that the membership of the committees could change, and since the society sunset would occur in 2023, there will be another election prior to that time, and so I would say it is likely that the membership of those two committees would change, simply as a result of the election. And then the other thought I was going to add, and we could confirm this, and James and Madam Chair, you may know, typically the assignment of the committees of reference or those assignments to be a committee of reference are assigned to an agency's, typically assigned to an agency's standing committees, meaning the standing Senate and House committees that an agency reports to.
Mr. Ponder would be the best one to answer that question. You're on mute, Bill.
There you go. Dale is absolutely correct on his statement there in terms of the assignments for the HS and the committee reference.
So which committee do we typically answer to?
Is it Jim Dale?
It's been a while since we've been asked of any commitment, so I'm not sure which committee we are currently assigned to.
And I just noticed in the chat that the bylaws don't reference 1107 funds, but the policy manual does. And that's what we will be voting on today. Okay. Anything, I don't want to hold up Dale or Josh any longer, but do you have anything else to for us to pay attention to? The last time we talked, you cautioned Dale that although we're trying to fix past recommendations and respond to them, and not to lose sight of where we stand currently on all those points of evaluation. Do you have any more to say about that?
Madam Chair, thank you. And just as and for that question, and as a final thought, and I'm going to specifically reference the collections management area as probably a really good example here of an area that we have looked at in several prior sunset reviews, and an area that has been a longstanding issue for the society. And so this would be, I think, an area I know in our couple of previous discussions that we've had over the past few months, I know this is an area that you're currently focused on, that you're making progress on. I know it's a big task simply because of the all the collections you do have, and in terms of managing and operating and providing those collections for the benefit of the public in accordance with various state laws and requirements. But I know at the time of our previous follow-up, the Society was making progress in that area, and as you've shared over the past few months, you do continue making progress. So that would be an area of focus I would suspect that the committees of reference would be interested in, and you're continuing progress in that area.
The criteria, the various areas that you evaluate, you expect those to change in any way, or are they fairly static, stable?
So, Madam Chair, when the committees of reference conduct the review, there are 13 statutory sunset factors that they will ask you to respond to, and there are 4 additional questions in statute that they will also ask you to respond to, and that would be somewhat the minimum requirement that they will ask you to report on. They may have other questions, other areas that they would ask you to address. And what we could do is Dot and I could send to James, we could send you a reference to the statute where those 13 questions and the additional 4 questions are, and so you could look at those and understand the types of information that the Corps would be asking you to provide.
Excellent. Okay, does anybody out there have a question that they're burning to ask for Dale or Dot? If don't, this is about the last time you can have access to the Auditor General's office. Anybody? Okay, Dot and Dale, thank you so much for taking your time out to do this. This board will do the right thing, and we'll keep track. We have a tracking document, so we'll keep in close track of our progress. So thank you very much. This is much appreciated. And if this is your new presentation, it is excellent. It is very, very good. Appreciate it very much. Okay.
Thank you, ma'am.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Okay. On the agenda next, and we'll come back to chapter roles. We'll come back to all that. But meanwhile, we need to approve the draft minutes from August 14th. Those have been distributed and need a motion to approve or correct or whatever. So.
Those are the draft, just to clarify, draft minutes from October 23rd, not August 14th.
Sorry. October 23rd. You're right.
So moved, Bruce.
Second.
Okay. Discussion?
Who seconded?
I did.
Tom Rose.
Okay. Any discussion? Any changes? Nothing? If not, we will accept it as submitted.
Do I
hear somebody?
Do you hear me?
Yes, now.
Do we need to vote on the minutes, on acceptance of the minutes?
No. That's just, that is not required other than just a voice vote. Yes, a voice vote. So
may I suggest that if we're doing a vote that we do it in the chat so that
I don't know how to do the chat for sure. I think we should do it the way we've been doing it. Raise our hand.
I'll just make this easy and do a voice vote. It's being recorded, Colleen. For your vote, Mr. Ballard?
Yes.
Denise? Yeah, this is going to be an issue, too, because of the audio. Denise, you can put it in the chat.
Yes, she voted.
All right. Well, Lorna Brooks?
Yes.
Thank you. Janice Dyson?
Yes, and I apologize, but last time I tried the chat, it disconnected me, so I don't want to try it again this time.
Holly Byron? You're on mute. Or you can put it in the chat.
Yes, and I'll put it in the chat too. Sorry.
Kelly Corsett.
Yes.
Thank you. Tom Foster.
Yes.
Bruce Quinn.
Yes.
Karen Holmbach.
Yes.
Mr. Rose.
Yes.
Greg Scott.
Yes.
Mr. Spencer.
Yes.
Mr. Wade.
Yes.
And Linda Whitaker.
Yes.
Okay.
Now we're going to move on. This is a call to the public. If there is somebody who wants to speak on an issue that is not on the agenda, please make yourself known, and we will recognize that, and you'll be allowed 3 minutes to speak on that topic. If you want to discuss something that is on the agenda, we'll give you 5 minutes, and we will recognize you just prior to the discussion to getting to that item on the agenda. So do I hear anything from the public who wants to speak to something that currently is not on the agenda? Anybody? Hearing none? James? Okay. Hearing none, we will move on. So from the current event, I don't want to even begin to go to current events at this point. I have nothing that pertains to this body. Let's see. Okay. Executive Director?
Okay, Linda. I've got about a half a dozen big topics that I'll try to keep short, and then happy to answer questions, and I know that the senior leaders are as well, regarding tons of material that we've sent out in the last couple of months since the October meeting. First up is, of course, legislative and gubernatorial relations. We continue to work very closely with the governor's office, and we have we have updated all of our legislative contacts, and we'll soon be reaching out to start scheduling probably virtual meetings during the upcoming session. In particular, we're working on communications to introduce the agency to the many new legislators we have in both wings of the state government this year. Next up, fundraising has actually been going pretty well. The work with the Friends of the Arizona Historical Society is progressing with regard to the feasibility study for the capital campaign, which was discussed at the October board meeting. There will be an RFQ that will go out hopefully within the next couple of weeks, and we should soon be able to make a selection about a firm to work with on the study and begin moving forward with that. Also, the annual appeal did quite well this year, and we had a very good end of the year with regard to membership. We continue to defy the trends in the field. We not only have we held steady, I think we actually gained somewhere in the range of 12 to 15 members in December, and we're seeing great progress with current members increasing the level of their membership. So overall, though we have a steady and slightly increasing membership, we're actually bringing in a lot more dollars for membership than previously. And we even have new folks at the director's circle, the $1,000 level. The strategic plan, we're working with the Sunset Review and Reaccreditation Task Force, as you know, to streamline the reporting, the tracking document for the strategic plan. And we're about to meet as a leadership team to update our quarterly aspirational goals as a team, which, of course, are always drawn from the strategic plan. Sunset Review, that task force, has met a couple of times and will continue to meet again. Thank you, Linda and Colleen, for your service on that task force. With regard to American Alliance of Museums reaccreditation, per the leadership report, we did get all of the materials submitted on time on October 31st. Our program coordinator that we were assigned by AAM, Marcia, think of her a lot like, in a way, think of her like the, like Dale and Doc. It's Martha's job to help us succeed. They want to see organizations get reaccredited. So she conducted a review of the dozens of documents and the narrative questions that we answered in the self-study, and she had 9 findings from that. Again, remember, Martha's job is to make sure we are absolutely putting our best foot forward. So we were given a really short turnaround in December to address those findings. We addressed 8 of 9, and on the remaining finding, she gave us until this spring to finish up. There are some issues with our recently approved code of ethics, and I will be bringing those to your attention at the executive committee meeting window. So all board members, be aware of that. That will probably have to make a few little tweaks at the February board meeting. We will make sure that we get that out to you well in advance so that you have plenty of time to review. And last but not least, I hope everyone had a chance to read, to watch the Welcome to the Arizona Historical Society video. I want to give a big shout out to everybody that participated in that project. And I think it's something that we can all be proud of. So I know that Tawn and her team are happy to answer questions specifically about the video, and I'm here to answer questions about anything else I've reported on.
Tawn, job well done. It seems to me that this has multiple audiences and multiple uses. So from a communication standpoint, how are you going to use this?
So in addition to distribution through our normal channels, which is posting in social media, on our website, doing email campaigns, we're also going to reach out to our various partners. We have partners all across the state in various organizations, and we'll look to them to see if they will help us with distribution of this. We're also going to use it for donor development. It will be useful for grants. For, in particular, donor development when we're meeting with foundations, potential corporate sponsors, so that they can get a sense of who we are and what we're about, and how what we're doing aligns with our mission.
It's well done, and the sooner we can disperse it, the better. I think it's a very, very useful tool.
Thank you. Thank you. Kudos to Marilyn.
Any feedback from the board? Any other kind of questions or kudos or anything?
Kudos.
We have nods. That's what you're going to get today, Tom. You're going to get nods. The nods are good, okay?
Yeah. Kudos. Kudos. It's very nicely done, Tom.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Thank you. And special thanks to and kudos to Marilyn, who was the project manager. She drove this, and she deserves a huge amount of credit for this.
Yeah, she's great. Does a nice job.
Thank you.
Jane, you want to continue on your report?
Those were actually the 6 top highlights. If there are questions about those things or about anything else, now's the time to ask.
Do you have any updates regarding status of the downtown museum, et cetera?
Yes, I do. We have been working very hard to try to get all AHS materials out of the Downtown History Museum. That was the first priority. And the reason we chose that as the first priority is because that is where there are so many more collections And so this really gave us an opportunity not only to make sure that we preserve those collections and get them safely out of the facility in an orderly fashion. Also, it gave us a chance to meet our inventory numbers in Tucson, which, of course, is an ongoing issue that you heard about from Dale with regard to the sunset review. So all of the smaller, more easily moved objects have been removed from the facility and have been brought back to the Arizona History Museum. Trish and Rebecca are working on identifying the lenders so that we can get loans taken back. We have moved a couple of higher profile big pieces that I wish in a way we had been able to get some press over. There's a really cool cannon that David probably knows more about that did get moved back recently, about 500 pounds, I think, all 500 pounds of it, and is now in the Spanish Colonial Exhibition, which has opened at the Arizona History Museum. We've also gotten all excess materials out and in compliance with SOCLA rules. Eric has been working to get that stuff SOCLA, and we're currently working with the collections team to schedule the move of the larger objects that we typically are not able to do ourselves. Fort Lowell will come next, and Ridden, we've done everything we need to do. We continue to check in once a week, and our last day in the facility will be February 3rd.
And how soon did the savings on the MOUs get transferred to Jim Snitzer's Feel the Burn? I mean, when does that take place?
Right, Jim's working on that now. So the status of our finances at each of the three facilities, we continue to be responsible for utilities at Ridden per the existing agreement. The first day we can be out of that is February 3rd. All other expenses have ceased at Ridden. Our Downtown History Museum financial outlay is now at zero, the same for Fort Lowell. So Jim and the staff have been working, and also Robert Ballard and Bruce on the Revenue Generation Task Force to capture those savings. Where you're really going to see it is this is where a lot of those places are where there were vacant positions, and so that will be captured in salary savings, expense reduction.
There's just a question from Denise, and
There's a question from Denise, and apparently we skipped Nina in the call to the public, and should probably go back for that. Denise, I assume you're talking about, is this agency, meaning the Arizona Historical Society, connected to Arizona State Parks? We are not. If you're talking about Ridden Mansion is a state park and always has been a state park. We were a tenant that operated it for a period of about 9 years, I believe.
Well, I had been talking to one of our legislators who believed that state parks and museums were basically the same.
No.
Well, state parks and the Historical Society were the same. Thank you very much. I thought I missed something in orientation, but apparently not.
No, and further, it is rather confusing. There is actually a third agency of the state that runs historic sites and museums in addition to AHS and state parks. And that is, officially in the statute, it is the Prescott Historical Society, but they do business as Charlotte Hall Museum, which is why, like, we always joke that the Arizona Historical Society encompasses, its mission is the entire state except a bubble around Prescott.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Anything else, James, Attorney Pro? We'll come back. Nina's not currently at her desk, so we'll come back and see what kind of a question she has. Any more questions for Jane? Okay. I'm going to talk about board health. We are expecting, actually we're told at the end of December, to expect maybe as many as 9 or so appointees. They have completed the interviews, but in point of fact, we haven't heard from the governor's office. And so we are still waiting for that. We are prepared to do a big orientation for that group as a group. And so just know that it's still coming. As you know, we have asked Michael Wade to chair the governance committee. So we'll report on that a little bit later in terms of what they're working on and who are members of that committee. We are also going to strengthen the collections committee. We're going to have more professionals on that in the same way that we strengthened the finance committee of having specialists from around the state serve on that committee. We are going to do the same thing per Greg Stott's request. He's asked for this, and you heard from the auditors, they want to see evidence of more board oversight. Where do they find that? They find that in board meeting minutes, in committee reports, etc. And just so you know, all our committees are subject to the same open meeting laws, the posting of minutes, all that kind of thing. And you're going to see more activity there because there's going to be more people there. And that is a good thing. Other than that, I think the challenge is going to be what committees to put these new individuals on. I think it will depend on interest, expertise, that sort of thing. Note that we've given membership a hiatus here, and because our membership group has worked so hard on improving membership, this has been almost a staff function anyway. And the board has not been able to contribute very meaningfully in terms of membership activity, and the staff can move faster, move better, and do a better job of it. So no members on that, no new assignments on membership.
Linda, can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Kind of off topic, but I just thought of it as you were back about 4 sentences. So you talked about how committees are subject to the same open meeting laws, which include, of course, posting an agenda and posting minutes and all of that. This may be a moot question given the discussion we're going to have later, but I'm assuming that all chapters are also under those same requirements.
Absolutely.
But I haven't seen, and it's probably just because I'm new and I don't know where to look, but I haven't seen chapter meeting agendas or minutes posted somewhere. Am I just missing where they've been posted? Can you answer that for me? I mean, it may be a stupid question, but
it's not a stupid question, and it is not easy to find. It is more than 2 clicks away. So you have to go to, I think, the About Us menu option, and
Linda.
Pardon me?
I think you're misunderstanding me. I'm not asking about the committees. I have gone and looked.
But this is the same chapters.
I have not seen, and I went and looked. I went and I haven't seen chapter meeting agendas and minutes posted.
I'm gonna walk everybody through it, Linda. So go to ArizonaHistoricalSociety.org, hover on About, drop down just below State Board of Directors, click on Local Chapter Boards, and then click on the board that you're interested in, and everything will come up.
Thank you.
If you're looking for Northern Chapter, we haven't had meetings because of the difficulty of setting up audiovisual, and we don't want to meet in person. So we're going to start as soon as we can get everyone hooked up. Not all of our board members have computers and email, so you will find that there's a lot of vacancy in there, but if you go ahead and go through what James just ran on, you can find almost anything there. Yeah, if it's not there, it didn't happen, generally.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for that question. Nina. Nina, hello. Nina, unmute yourself. Ask your question.
Okay, well, I have two quick questions. One is the video that you talked about, where do we find that? Because I've heard from several league members
At this point, you don't, Nina. It has not been publicly circulated yet. It only was shared with staff and board. Tom's team will be working on a plan to launch.
Okay. That's correct. Thank you, James.
Okay, my second is about the accreditation. So the issue of the collection that the Sunset Review has noted, does that affect your accreditation?
Yes. Do you want me to elaborate on that?
A little bit, if you could.
Sure. I just didn't want to... We've talked about it a number of times. It's interesting that in many ways the reaccreditation process is actually far more rigorous than the Sunset Review processes in different ways. They're definitely going to be looking at the collections management and more holistically than they've ever done in the past, because remember that we're not just focused on the Arizona History Museum this time. For the first time ever, we're trying to get both historic sites in Yuma and Flagstaff, as well as the Heritage Center and the Arizona History Museum, accredited. As someone who has been an accreditation reviewer for 10 years, I can say that the one thing that stands us in good stead at this point is all the work that's been done over the past 2.5 years to develop a plan to deal with the problem. So A, we have a plan, and B, we have no intention of hiding the warts during the visit. Those are the two things that will sink an organization in an accreditation review. The best strategy is absolute transparency and having a plan to deal with the problem.
Okay. Well, thank you.
And, James, you are executing the plan. We have a remedial plan, and you are, you prioritize that, and you are executing that. So, no, we won't be perfect, but we'll be better, and I am very hopeful, dare I say optimistic, about the four locations being approved. This would be huge. James, one more thing. Do we know if this is going to, this will be an in-person inspection. Just talk me through it. When do we expect people to show up or to press the talk?
Again, it's looking like it's going to be between mid-March and mid-April. And at this point in time, up to this point, AAM has been giving institutions the option to decide. The trend that I'm starting to see, though, is that that option may be taken away because of COVID numbers, and it may just go virtual. I can tell you that I'm doing a review of another institution at the end of January, and that one is now becoming a hybrid. It's an on-site tour of their facility, and all the rest is going virtual. So it's going to depend a little bit on our reviewers and their comfort level with traveling.
But our review can take place anytime between March and...
It'll be mid-March to mid-April.
Okay.
We're finalizing that scheduling soon.
Is there a role for the board in that? Did they talk to members of the board or what?
Yes, they will want to. That is, that's usually left to the discretion of the reviewers. And so, like, for example, I was asked as the reviewer for this other museum what meetings I wanted to see on the agenda. It's absolutely, they will want to have meetings with members of the governing body. How they do that depends from review to review. I've never been in one where they asked for an entire board to meet. They usually ask for a selection of members.
Okay. Any other questions related? Does that answer your question, Nina?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anything else regarding reaccreditation? That's coming up fast. Real fast. Okay, let's go on to Jim Snitzer's report and with Bill and Tim as needed. Jim, take it away.
Okay. Let's see. James, can you bring up the top level overview, that one pager?
Yes, sorry, Jim. I should have.
While he's bringing it up, I'll draw your attention. This, you'll notice that these are blocks of nine lines. There are nine lines that I look at, and that's a condensation of a huge amount of stuff that Jim has. The financials are extremely complicated. Every number is connected to every other number, and every number is in motion, so it's not an easy chore. Hats off to Kim. I absolutely urge everybody, in Kim's report, she gives us three reports, and one of her reports has nine pages. Those nine pages correspond to these nine lines, and so you can...
That's a quick question. Sorry, Jim. Are you guys able to see... The top level overview? Okay, good. Sorry.
Okay. And I absolutely encourage you to, for instance, grab Kim's page, the nine-page report, the one that at the top left says Enterprise, and see if you can track these numbers that I end up reporting in my sheet. She's got a lot of other numbers that explore the detail. But up until now, I will continue at the board level just to try and focus on something quick and simple, but but there is more to the story, and so please look at those nine pages. So the where we are right now, notice up at the top, I have removed the one-time donation that is in Kim's numbers of $1.6 million, and that was what we transferred basically toward the fundraising effort, which actually answers one of the big concerns of the Auditor General. So my numbers are stripped down to just, I'll say, the bare essentials. That first lot we've already looked at before, and that's just the budget for the year. And we budgeted that we were going to end up with a yellow number, end up with a smaller ending balance. The balance is the amount of money we have left, and that's a critical thing, and we'll look at it a little more later. Now, next block is year-to-date. And this is through November 30th. We don't have the December numbers yet. And so you can see it's actually a little bit better than budget. That yellow number shows an ending balance, but that's misleading. That's because we have had more money coming in than we have spent, especially in appropriate. And so that will self-correct. And if anybody has any questions, I'll be glad to slow down. Not everybody is as fascinated with numbers as I am. So if you're not a numbers hound, we'll just keep going. The next group is the forecast for 2021. And this is just my best guess. And it's essentially unchanged versus the last forecast. We've had some things up, some things down, but not by much. And then getting down to that last group of numbers at the bottom, that loss number, let me go back into the forecast. If you look at that group of numbers forecast, the population endpointer says right now we're forecasting to end with the balance at the end of this year of 1,042,590. And two numbers to the left of that, you see that 622,952. That's how fast I feel we are burning through our capital. And that's what I call the fuel to burn rate. And it's a difficult number to work with, but it's, in one sense, it's simple to understand. It's how fast it burns through our remaining capital. But it's, from an accounting standpoint, it's very difficult to get to, trust me. So then down below, I just say, hey, basically, we're still kind of in not great shape. At the current rate, at the end of 2021, up above, we said we did with $1 million. If we burn through another 622,952, we'll end up at the end of 2022, next year, the end of next fiscal year, with 419,000. That's essentially shut down money. If we get to that point, we've got no flexibility left. So part of this is we've got to respond. We've got to either cut expenses or increase revenue. And we're not going to shut down. I refer to that as shutdown money, but we're not going to shut down, but we have to, at that point, if we haven't done anything to fix it by then, we have to do triage. We have to start amputating parts of the operation to maintain the parts that are essential. Okay, so let me stop here. Any questions on just this part of it?
I have a question for Tim or for Bill. Do we have any insights, or is it too soon to ask about expected allocations from the state? Do we know anything more now than we knew before?
No, nothing new.
Okay, well then James, let's bring up that sheet that's the top level narrative. And that number I talked about a minute ago, that 622,000 burn rate, and that's not far from where we started back in September. Back then, I think we were at 667,000 burn rate. And just to remind everybody, again, to show you how difficult these numbers are to get your arms around, we said back then that the true burn rate was probably closer to $1 million. But we had already done some extreme cost reductions by eliminating some heads. Some of those were associated with the MOUs. And for that reason, you know, you say, okay, well, we made this decision on the MOUs. Doesn't that have a big impact on the burn rate? And the answer is yes and no. It has a big impact because if you figure the burn rate used to be $1 million, now it's down to 600. That's good, but it doesn't reduce it below my numbers by much. So this is just, this narrative that we're looking at now is just an even shorter version of the prior one page. And it says exactly what I just said. You know, in 2020, we ended the year with 1,665,545 of remaining capital, May remaining capital. We budgeted to draw that down to 1.5 million. The 2021 latest forecast is to draw that down to 1,042,000, and the latest 2022 numbers are that we'll draw it down to 419, and that's shut down. So So that just restates the things on the other page. And then now let me stop. Are there any questions on this page?
I have a question.
Yep.
And this is kind of a pre-mortem question that I'll use with clients where you say, okay, we have a particular course of action, a strategy. If that doesn't work, is there anything that we'll look back on and say, we should have done this at that particular time, or we should have done this earlier? Because I think a lot of us are a little nervous about, is there anything that we should be considering taking action on now that if we just kind of rush past it, we may regret having lost that opportunity?
I'll let James answer that if there is one. I think the answer is we've already taken a huge amount of action, that there are very few cost reductions left. There are things we need to do on the revenue generation front. The biggest thing we can do, we did, hats off to the board. We took that $1.6 million and we earmarked it for fundraising. It's like that movie where it says, help me, Obi-Wan, you're my only hope. You know that. That is our great hope for the future of this organization, is to take that money that we have so wisely, at a time when we're starting to we dedicated $1.6 million to fundraising, good for us. I'm so proud that we did that. It was hard to ignore, all these things that are on fire right now, and say we're gonna forget these alligators, we're gonna drain the swamp, we're gonna ensure our future, even as we struggle through the short term stuff. And then James, any comments on other action?
I'd like Bill and Kim to weigh in as well, but I just want to remind people, going back to the organizational health overview was what it was called, that we looked at the PowerPoint in the June meeting. We did a deep dive into the health of the organization and its trajectory over the past 20 years. And honestly, if we were having this conversation in the 2001 recession, Michael, or the 2000, the Great Recession, the answer to your question would be absolutely. And I don't know if those things were done at that time or not. What I can tell you is that we're now left with an organization that is by and large, it's people. We're talking about people. That's it. And as Bill can explain, and Mel and Kim, as a state agency, we've implemented the only thing that we can in terms of having flexibility with regard to personnel, and that is not filling vacated positions. But, there's a step-by-step process that the state developed at the beginning of the pandemic and recession as to how things would go if an agency didn't have the funding to meet payroll. Bill, can you elaborate on that at all?
I can, but James, Kim was actually part of the meetings where that strategy was laid out. So let's let her talk about that, so that those specific steps that they advise us to look at are perfectly clear.
The state has said that they did not want to cut salaries or positions in the beginning, that they wanted to look at other funds to help with the shortfalls. And then the third step would be appropriations and cutting positions. So they laid out four different steps. But as far as that was, they were going to look at other funds first, and they didn't want to do risk.
Okay.
Now, something I can add to that, Michael, that is a bit of good news. Let me just, I want to get the name just right for you, because Nina asked in the chat about, well, hey, what about PPE dollars or CARES Act dollars, and we were deemed ineligible for those as a state agency. However, in the latest stimulus package that was passed at the very beginning of January in the but the new COVID-19 relief bill, there is a section titled 324, Grants for Shuttered Venue Operators. Now, I realize that's very amorphously defined, but it is $15 billion of stimulus dollars, and museums, along with theaters and performing arts agencies, are eligible for those models. So OSPB reached out to us. Kim and Jennifer Hunt and I prepared the documentation that was needed. It was a very quick turnaround. We had about 72 hours. It's at OSPB as of this morning. So fingers crossed. We have clearly documented the losses that we have sustained. It's possible that we could get some relief.
Okay, now, James, if you could bring up that feel the burn sheet, and that will be my last contribution, I hope. That feel the burn, we just thought that was a catchy title, but it's trying to simplify a very, very complicated situation to a company, and so that's what we're working with. And you can see we started out with a burn rate of 666.97. That's where we started. And we've got to reduce that to zero. And then scroll down the sheet just a little bit. You can see where we started. Since then, we've had an improved forecast because we had good news on membership, donations, and grants. Now, so that 622, that's what I just reported to you as the burn rate. Now, there's some opportunities. Something we're going to discuss in a minute is the 1107 fund, and that was the recommendation of the Auditor General, and I'd like to amplify what I said before. I take auditor comments very, very, very seriously. I came out of the corporate world, and in that world, you either comply immediately with an auditor's comment or you challenge the comment immediately, and the challenge has to be something like, there's something you weren't aware of. It's our fault we didn't make you aware of this. We didn't make you aware of that. And, but the Auditor General, in this sense, I look at them as the eyes and ears of our most important shareholder, the legislature, and how the Auditor General feels about us is pretty much going to be how the legislature feels about us. And the Auditor General basically saying, we don't think this $35,000 state money productive. So I asked the question, can we challenge that? Do we feel that we have been spending it productively? And the answer was, no, we really can't challenge it. We think the Auditor General has a point. So we're going to be asking the board approval in a minute to take that cost savings, which would reduce the burn rate, because that's definitely in there. And then down below, there's a blank, the Revenue Generation Task Force. It's not blank because they haven't been doing anything. They've been doing everything. They are working very, very hard. Again, very, very complicated situation. Preliminarily, we've got a complicated look we're taking at increasing revenue and reducing expenses, both sides. So far, we've identified not quite another 100,000. So we think there's a way to get the burn rate down to 500,000. When you think we started at 666, now we're down to 500,000. That's great. The problem is $500,000 a year is still an enormously bad burn rate. Still a big problem. So we hope to have some more detailed, more easily understood information from a Revenue Generation Task Force in something I call board worthy. For me to bring something to the board, I want to understand it myself first. And then we want to be able to explain it to you, and it has to be short, simple, and truthful. And so we're refining those numbers. It'll be a month or two before we really feel solid, but it doesn't mean that nothing's happening. There's tons of stuff happening. And then the bottom line there is our big, giant risk, and even that's why Linda asked that question. So, if there are any questions, I'll ask them. Otherwise, that's the extent of my report is Craig.
Okay. No other questions for Jim? No other questions. Yep. Unmute.
I was trying to put it on the chat. So I was wondering, is there any way you can consolidate or downsize some of the museums? Because a little bit of something is better than a lot of nothing.
James, do you want to address that? James, did you want to address that?
I'm pondering that question, Linda. That is what Jim is talking about when we get to, if we get to, the end of 2022, at which point we're almost broke. So there's a lot of things that we could do, Nina, but if I were to give voice to any one of those, it would trigger an immediate firestorm right now, and I don't think that that's in our best interest.
Right. Oh, I understand. I mean, that's not my point. I'm just wondering if there's some way we can do something preemptively.
Just one comment from a corporate guy who spent a lot of time in the corporate world, and there's always the temptation, if you're doing cost reduction, to cut everything by 10%, cut everything by 10%. But you run into the operations that had a lot of fat and survived. The operations that were already lean and mean get crippled because they don't have any fat. And so you can't, if you're in extremists, and I've been there with organizations, you want to stop looking at 10% reductions everywhere and look at where can I lop off 10% of my operations entirely, because I want whatever's left to have enough money to be strong, to be operationally strong, and you're better to be strong somewhere than weak everywhere.
I think to further elaborate on that, Jim and Nina, I think what Jim is doing is showing us the reality, and it's important that we all understand that and that we're making very conscious decisions. That also being said, I am often not the one that takes a Pollyanna view, but I do believe that we'll come out of this, and I don't think that in the here and now is the time to start talking about very, very drastic measures, because there's a lot of things that are still in play, and we have to be patient. Even the worst naysayers in our field, myself included, are seeing a rebound in fourth quarter of 2021 for cultural institutions, which would mean that our revenue streams would come back. Some of them, I want to point out, in fact, our biggest revenue stream of all, facility rentals, may come roaring back because there is such pent-up demand. So, I think Jim's right to keep us apprised. I think we're demonstrating to auditors and to the legislature that we're being very thoughtful and we're very conscious of the situation. We're documenting that. But it's not time to press the panic button yet.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
And Kylie's right. We're ramping up with the capital campaign. We also have the possibility of COVID-19 relief dollars. And we, as Bruce and Jim and Robert can attest, we're doing every single thing we can to increase existing revenue streams and to bring in new revenue streams. So it's just one of those nail biters. I wish I could be more comforting.
Okay. Next, towards that end, we have recommendations by the Finance Committee to eliminate 1107 funds and with a proposed very specific wording about how that policy would be rewritten. The other thing, there are several reasons for doing this, but when we look at the finances, you trim or consolidate or redirect where you can, and that is the intent of the 1107 funds. You saw it on Jim's Field of Burn. There are two things, at least, that are moving this, and it started with the Finance Committee. They saw an opportunity here to trim, redirect those funds in a more consolidated way to be dispersed in a timely manner. Second, Sunset Review. And they did separate it out from the existence of chapters. They saw it as a separate issue. And therefore, this takes care of a number of concerns. The other thing I have a question for is, Tim, how much money is left jointly in the 1107 money? The last report, we had it about $68,000. Is that the case?
Yes, that's still pretty accurate.
But it says here, and I'll read it to you, the recommendation is to eliminate revenue sharing with the chapters. Chapters are formally absolved of responsibility to fundraise for AHS. That no additional 1107 monies will be allocated, but there are 6 months for the local boards to act to spend down those funds. So any unspent 1107 monies will be spent by June 30th, 2021 on AHS-approved projects, or if it's not spent down, it gets reallocated within AHS. So that is how this is worded. The spend down is so that this money, in fact, is still under the control of local chapter boards, but it cannot sit there. One of the things the AGs has a problem with is unspent money and then coming back and asking for additional state funds. They want to see these monies expended for which they were intended. They cannot sit there and aggregate over time. They want it spent down. So that is how this motion reads. So there's a sunset part of this, and then there is a impact on the budget part of this. Something that is within our control to do and not just dependent on the state. That is how this reads, and I am putting this motion down, and I am looking for a second, and then we could have discussion.
But it's a motion from a committee, so it doesn't require a second.
Okay.
I have a question or two on your discussion portion. I'm fine with doing exactly what we're doing here, but as far as from governance point of view, if this is just a resolution, or is this a proposed change to policy manual? If we're going to completely remove 1107 funds, we need to change Section 5, Part 2 of the bylaws and policy 9.1.
Not bylaws, policy.
But the bylaws do still cover that.
That can be corrected in due course. It does not have to be corrected ahead of time. We act and then change accordingly.
Okay, so we're doing a policy change today.
That is correct.
Very good. That's all I wanted to know. And all it basically is going to do is take, let me look at my policy. So policy change would possibly require someone to move that 9-1 and 9-4 be deleted from the policy manual.
That to me looks like a deletion, not an addition, yes.
Because those two are the only ones that really pertain to membership dues distributions other than that are specifically on 1107 funds. I've got it right here in front of you. Number
yes,
one. Okay, so basically we could propose that we delete items 9-1 and 9-4 and renumber 9-2 and 3 to read 9-1.
But we need this, but at some point, we need a very clear policy statement that 1107 funds, that this does not come up again. This cannot come up again because we'll have the same situation.
It won't.
Okay.
It won't. We're just removing 1107 funds from the policy manual.
Tom, if you just bear with me for a moment, I'm going to try to smoosh together what was on the agenda and what you said into the chat box because it's very important that we get this right, and then you guys can react to it, okay?
Okay.
Just give me a moment.
Just we could agree on the wording of it, but in principle, we're talking about eliminating 1107 funds, and that is what we should be voting on now. We also want to extend a chance for chapters to spend it down.
Yes.
Okay? So for the purpose of this board, but is on the floor, is this wording that helps to protect chapters, gives them time to think about this and spend it down. There's also
I believe I captured that all in the chat. Please take a close look at that and let me know if I got that right. Just start it where it says recommendation, because I typed two things in at the same time.
Since there are people who don't have access to the chat, somebody probably...
I can read it, Colleen. This is going to... I see a chaos with the vote, but I'll read it. But the recommendation is to... It's exactly the wording that was on the agenda. The recommendation is to eliminate revenue sharing with the chapters. Chapters are formally absolved from the responsibility to fundraise for AHS. No additional 1107 monies will be allocated. Any unspent 1107 monies will be spent by June 30th, 2021 on AHS-approved projects or reallocated within AHS. The AHS Board Policy Manual will be amended to delete items 9.1 and 9.4 and renumber 9.2 and 9.3. That's in recognition of Tom's observation.
I have a question, and that is, would it not be possible to just change that last part to say the AHS Board Policy Manual will be amended amended to reflect this change?
That would be good.
And I don't want to have some little other provision pop up that we didn't address. So we can say this is clearly what's being done. We amend the policy manual accordingly.
I like it. That's clean and it's accurate.
That works. That works. Well,
Michael, did I get that right? The AHS Board Policy Manual will be amended accordingly to reflect that change.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to call the vote. It will be a voice vote, and we will just call it as we would normally call it. So, James, do you want to walk us through that?
Certainly. I'll just go in the order.
Who's ever still there?
I can. Robert had to go to another meeting. Robert Ballard, your vote?
Yes.
Denise Bauer?
Yes.
Lorna Brooks?
Yes.
Dennis Bryson?
Yes.
Colleen Byron?
Yes.
Kelly Corsett?
Yes.
Tom Foster?
Yes.
Bruce Gwynn?
Yes.
Karen Hornbeck?
Yes.
Tom Rose?
Yes.
Greg Scott?
Yes.
Jim Smitzer?
Yes.
Michael Wade?
Yes.
Linda Whitaker?
Yes. So.
That's unanimous.
Excellent. I thank you for this because it allows actually for I think an open discourse. This is behind us. Now we look to the future. Okay, and let's talk about the roles of chapters and just generally the roles of chapters and outline where there are some issues, and also, we can talk about all kinds of changes in the roles, further, maybe delineations of their roles, but there are certain things that aren't negotiable. Chapters currently, and it will continue to be, part of AHS. And while it is onerous for us as a board, but they're going to have to comply with meetings, posting ahead of time. The staff can help them do that. If you go with how our Zoom is set up, it's automatically recorded. Those recordings can be posted in minutes. And it'll be compliant with the open meeting laws, but it's essential that this is complied with. It is not an option, but we understand that it is onerous. And if for any number of reasons that a chapter can't do it, we need to know. The other thing is this, it is also obvious in terms of our own chapter descriptions. Chapters do not have a role in operations. They don't control collections. They don't control exhibits. They don't control daily operations in general, and we know that there is at least one chapter that wants to do all of that, and that is also non-negotiable. We say they're advisory. There has to be room for that. There is room for that, but you need a party willing to meet and to discuss this. We cannot go back to how things evolved or what were. There is a great opportunity here. I think Michael sees that opportunity. I see that opportunity to function within these guidelines. But it may be local boards don't want to do it. It may be that they want it the way it was before. And we can't do that. That is outside how those advisory boards should function. There are lots of other ways that they can function and can help us, but operations is not one of them. The other thing is this maybe being relieved from the fundraising aspect of it, maybe that, not that it's been done, but that may that may feel better in some ways. That also means they don't have control of money. So those are the parameters. There are some things the state won't let us do. And the money control, the money reporting is one of them. You've taken care of it. Now what? So talk to me in terms of there are any number of guidelines, rules of engagement, whatever you want to call it, that we can put down. We can have a summit meeting and discuss this with board presidents. But I want to ask you, if this is not agreeable, if these guidelines are not agreeable to chapters, then we need to rethink that. I am not looking to get rid of them. I am looking for a way to make them more meaningful, more viable, but it may not be, that vision may not sync with their vision. Michael, I know you'll have something to say about this.
Just a few things. First off, I believe that if you do have some rogue chapter, if you have some chapter that says flaunting open meeting law requirements and things of that nature, we've always had the capacity to say, hey, give a warning, audit, give recommendations. And if you have some chapter that in essence fires itself because it's no longer part of the organization, it's really trying to operate completely on its own out there. As the state board, you have the capacity to say, well, you know, you're no longer a chapter.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I think it's good to operate with the assumption that most chapters are going to be, they'll want to be in compliance, they want to be supported. One thing that I know that the governance committee is going to be exploring, and we talked about it the other day at our meeting, and we have a meeting coming up fairly soon, is the idea where the chapter becomes the relationship builder. And in fact, that's always been cited as one of the big strengths for chapters, because they're closer to the customers, they're out there in the community, they can have contact with state legislators, and so if they're a relationship builder, they're going to be doing some things that not only will avoid conflicts with staff responsibilities and with operations, but will give AHS a higher profile in the community, can help us with a number of opinion makers out there, and it will also be the sort of responsibility that board members can do painlessly. As it stands, if you turn to people and said, we want you to go out there and raise money, raising money is difficult. It's a challenge. And there are a lot of people who are very, very reluctant to ask for money. And with membership, you turn to someone and you say, gee, become a member. That's also going to be daunting in some cases, because the membership is not necessarily inexpensive. And you're going to have some people are going to think, well, do I really want to do this? But if we have the chapters focusing on building relationships, obtaining contact information, building up a pool that could eventually be used as a recruitment pool for membership, certainly an advertising pool for events, that is a painless process that at the same time is extremely valuable. And so I think one thing that, and of course, as I mentioned, the governance committee is going to be working on this, but one thing to keep in mind is the possibility of the chapters being one of our primary relationship builders. And it's a job they can do. Many times they're extremely well suited, because you'll have a cross section of people on the chapter board, and it's not putting them into a set of responsibilities in which they're almost doomed to failure.
Tom, I have a question for you. Given what Michael has suggested and the other sort of limitations, guardrails under which to function, is this something that LAG can live with? Or do you see, I don't know what you see there. Tell me what you see. Tom.
In regards to what Michael said?
In regards to the kind of roles that Michael has laid out, the fact that it will not be, that local chapters won't have anything to do other than support staff, no operations responsibility.
Absolutely no operations at all. I don't believe that that has come into an issue in Northern. I don't know of the other hands-on with any other chapter. I believe that basically chapters should be a piece of, an integral part of the historical society structure, and mainly advisors as to what their particular localities need, because it's not always apparent at the state level what is needed in perhaps Yuma, or even in Phoenix, or especially in Flagstaff, quite far away. Eastern has some responsibilities. The issue there is they don't have a museum, so there's no operations that they need to be involved in. But we do need this to have some input from people in those areas as to how to get in touch with their local people for support for AHS and issues along that line. And I see chapters' responsibilities mostly are in support of either their local or the state overall operation. And basically, we're just there to support you. You need somebody to man a book gift shop for a while, work in an event, do anything like that, or come up with suggestions for fundraising or even public affairs. We need an interface between AHS and our local citizens.
Bruce? What do you think regarding Yuma?
I like what Michael said, and we talked about it the other day.
Yeah.
And we have a model in place here in Yuma, the county sheriff, and it's a foundation board. It's not elected. You are appointed. There's 40 of them. You don't have any power of anything except when the fair comes on, you're asked to come help. And when they have other events out there, you're asked to come help. But from that 40 people, the main board sees who's working hard and who isn't. And so they reach out and ask certain individuals to become part of the fair board. But and then once a year, they get a steak dinner. And as I was telling Michael, they get a free pass into the fair. And it's amazing how hard people will work to get a free pass to park your car inside the fairgrounds. I did it for 20 years before I figured out that parking pass. I could buy that a lot cheaper. But we were part of that event, and we helped mold that event, and we helped put our input in there. So I want to explore that more and bring that to our next meeting. But I think the local chapter is just what Tom said. We need to let you know what we like down here. Can we help flavor it? Nobody knows better what's going on down here than we do. And so I think that part is really important. But as far as running the event, do we need to run it? We can volunteer for it when you need help running it. If we can get the right help putting the exhibits together, which we do, that's great. But we, you know, those are my thoughts. I am about half excited to start this process of building the foundation down here. And the foundation is free with the fair board, but it won't be free with us. We're going to make them pay for that steak dinner. Anyway.
Michael, are you thinking of drafting for the executive committee or the board some specific or further delineation of their roles? Are you going to do some further modification of the of this policy or this this policy as it stands now? Where should this appear? That's number one. Number two is I can't imagine doing this and then not have a I'm going to call it a summit meeting, saying that this is what we're considering. How do you weigh in on this? What do you have to say about this? And if people don't want to meet with us, that says enough. And dialogue can stop and we can rethink, what to do with that particular region or that area. Am I wrong on this? I mean, in terms of process, do you want to put something down that we can consider and then bring it before the chapters? What I don't want to see, Michael, is that we only have one or two people acting as emissaries on behalf of the whole board so that people need to be informed as we go and then we participate as a board. So tell me.
As I see this, the governance committee is going to meet, and we may well be able to come up with a draft of a policy statement or a resolution that would then go to the full board. But we're not going out there meeting with chapters. That's your territory. And then the full board can decide how to proceed from there. I'm sure the people on the governance committee are going to have a lot of ideas in terms of how we might approach this, but we're very much in a position of brainstorming, reviewing options, bringing them to the board with regard to the documentation that would be required, and then it's a proposal that goes to the board for consideration, and you take it from there. But we're not going to, I mean, our job is to meet and bring it to the board.
Okay, thank you, it makes it cleaner. You put in a lot of work on this that didn't go anywhere. And I want to make sure that the work that you do put in now has a platform to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. Okay? No more wasted efforts here. There are too few of us at this point and too much work to do. Does anybody else want to weigh in on this?
Would suggest that as a member of the governance committee, I agree with Michael as to what we proposed, but I would like to expand it to be a group of options or suggestions, and then I would recommend that the either the executive committee or staff, executive director, approach the presidents of the chapters with that options that we present to make sure that they get the communication. I think that was the thing we heard in August and earlier was that there was lack of communication. So I envision the governance committee coming up with some proposals as to the relation of the of chapters and duties of functions, et cetera, providing them to the board, and having the board approach, chapters to get their input or their input on the, proposals and then work from there to get a refined,
That sounds
policy.
Go ahead. Somebody else wants to chime in?
I'd like to, Linda. I would respectfully request that that be a role of the executive committee. It is completely inconsistent with the messaging that the staff has received from this board over a period of the last 2.5 years to expect us to have a role in interfacing with the chapters about something of this much importance.
Right.
As I said often, early and often, this board births them, this board gets to deal with them.
We accept those responsibilities, and we'll carry, I'm very eager to see what your group comes up with. Kelly, do you have anything to add to this?
I just wanted to, you know, this kind of follows on with what James just said. I think the biggest thing, and the thing I always worried about working with the central chapter is we certainly didn't want to be a burden on staff, which is already stretched way too thin. Frankly, the central chapter has been largely dormant for a while. Because we really haven't had anything to do. So I guess what I would like to hear from James and his team, and of course it doesn't have to happen now, but what does James think the chapter boards could do? Is it in the area of membership and building membership, as Michael suggested, or is it with something else? I think with the recalibration of our statewide fundraising efforts, capital campaign efforts that James is leading up, I think that's something we've needed for a long time. I think relieving the chapters of that particular responsibility will help clear things up. But I know in Central Chapter, I would definitely want to know from James and his team, what value could we add for you? And then I think that would be something I would support in terms of clarifying that as a chapter's role moving forward.
Jay, you want to respond to that? I think it sounds like a good idea, but go ahead.
Well, like I said, James doesn't have to answer that now, but I do think that's important.
What I would say, Kelly, is that what I've heard from Mr. Rose and Mr. Wade today is not inconsistent or incompatible with things that we have talked about on the staff side. So I eagerly await the options that Mr. Rose has talked about that we could look at them. I worry a little bit about whether or not in some regions where the chapters have become less active, if that role has been basically filled. When there's a vacuum, something usually comes up to fill that void. So we'll have to look at that.
Yeah, I just got a question. Would it make sense going forward if, I mean, with whatever organization we end up with, whether it's a chapter or some other historical organization, if we would just do a 1 or at most 2 year charter with them, and at the end of that 1 year or 2 year, if we, rather than getting this long, agonized process, if we feel it's not working for us, we just don't renew the charter.
I would, if I can comment on that, view that as sort of like a prenuptial agreement. And I don't think I would feel very warmly if the state board were to come to me as a chapter president or a chapter board member and say, well, we kind of have this little relationship, and but we can leave you after a certain period of time. No. They're part of the historical society. They're an important part of the organization. You want to send that signal, and you don't want to send the signal that you're looking over their shoulder at someone else. And so I can understand the convenience of that sort of arrangement, but on all of these things, you know, you have the prose and you have the poetry. And it's important not to forget the poetry.
because the poetry gets into emotional issues, personal commitments, how important people feel, how much respect they believe they are given. And I just think we need to be a little wary on that. So if we're able to get the chapters to the point where they have a very clear role, they're fulfilling it successfully, it's benefiting the organization, it's helping us locally, it's building all sorts of ties that perhaps were not built before, in my book, that's a giant success.
I really agree with what you just said, but I look at it as not as a marriage. I look at it as an alliance, and I'm concerned because it hasn't been working. We haven't fixed it. That's what the Auditor General said years ago. I mean, years ago, the Auditor General said this is not working. Fix it. And since then, it has continued not to work. He has continued not to fix it. So we need not to repeat that. Whatever we do, there has to be recognition that, hey, if we're not happy, we need to see so. And if things need to change, they need to change. But, somebody needs to, everybody, it's like my relationship with my boss. We had all kinds of discussions, but it was very important for me always to remember which one of the two of us was the boss.
So I have a question for staff about our community partners that are not chapters and how that all interacts. I have heard a lot about chapters, but I know the chapters are not our only community partners, but I don't know enough about that. That's not under the umbrella, but still very vital to our organization aspect of community partnership. So I'm wondering if James or possibly you could ask some of your staff who are more directly involved with community partnerships to explain that to us all a little bit better.
Bob, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yes.
Well, I'd sort of like to start with that, if I could. So I think that that's a very important question that is definitely an important part of the discussion, because what we're ultimately talking about here that Tom and Michael are proposing is community relationship building. So we want to make sure that what we're doing comprehensively as an organization statewide all gels together. And it's kind of what I was alluding to when Kelly asked his question, that, in the areas where chapters have not been active, the vacuum has kind of organically been filled. So I'd like for staff, I know this is unexpected and off the top of your head, but I'm going to limit you each to 1 minute. Give us one example of what Colleen is talking about, but let's not talk about our bigger partnerships, which we have upwards of 36 of. We have a lot of what we've come to call community voices, Linda. They fill the role that Tom and Michael have been talking about, but I think it's important to understand specifically how. So, Tom, do you have an example in Central?
I sure do. And thank you, Colleen. You beat me to the punch because I wanted to offer this out there because we, as just one example of what we did here in Tempe, is we created an exhibit called A Place for All People, and it was about African American history. And we felt like we really needed to hear from our African American community in order to create this exhibit. And so we identified some community leaders within that African American community, and grew a group organically from the first 4 or 5 people, and through those relationships they helped us grow that. And it was we had representatives from around the state, and this group helped us find their voice and to tell their stories, which we as an agency here in Tempe weren't equipped to tell. They helped us curate the exhibit. They created programs, and they were magnificent community partners. And we retain those relationships, and we call on them periodically when we need their advice. And this is the kind of community relationship building that we want to continue to grow across all the various communities in our respective regions.
Would you call them?
Thank you, Todd.
Todd?
Sorry?
These were your experts?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. They know their history better than we do.
Yeah.
Eric, do you have an example?
We continue to work with the Hispanic community here in Tucson because I feel it's a market that we miss. We miss local Hispanics as well as Mexican Americans and the Mexican tourists. And so I think we've done some good things with partnerships, for example, with Los Descendientes. I've put in an idea, approval for a program in May where we can discuss some of these cultural ideas and influences on our community to help spark some interest and to tie in more of these Hispanic leaders in our local Tucson community with what we do and with what our mission is here at AHS.
That's great. Thank you. Rebecca, do you have an example?
So one that comes to mind for me is that through our connections with other state agencies like Arizona Highways, and through all of the contacts that we have been able to build on our social media platforms like Instagram, there was an opportunity that was brought to our attention, which we were able to seize that we might not otherwise been able to have done, and that was to secure the donation of the Paul Markow photographic collection. This is a very important collection, represents images from the 1930s, 1940s, all the way to 2009. It's about 90,000 images. And so once we started that conversation with the Markow family, we came to find out that another collection which we had brought in from Al Payne and another collection which we already had, the Mazanovich collection, we now have this community of artists that all know each other. And they're all represented in our collection.
Oh, cool. Thank you. Yana, do you have an example? I'll give them away.
Sure. Collaboration is definitely key in NUMA, and I feel so fortunate because I feel like I have an army here in NUMA of support. But there's a great deal of collaboration among others who are involved in cultural organizations. Yuma Crossing National Heritage Area that represents two large museums here in Yuma is a strong partner of ours. They also are connected very, very closely with some Indian tribes, and we work with the Yuma County Children's Museum that's actually helping us with our upcoming Redondo Days fundraiser. So a lot of our voices that we listen to are coming from people who are involved with other museums here in Yuma, and the belief is that we are stronger together.
Thank you. Okay, David?
Yeah, I mean, I think a good example for me is the journal. The journal has a formal editorial board, and I've recruited nationally for that board, but I have sort of an informal network here in Arizona at the three major universities. I've developed relationships with professors in the history departments at all three universities, and I lean on them for advice and introductions and things like that all the time. If you look at this past year, 2020, we had two special issues that we produced. One was guest edited by a professor at ASU. Another was guest edited by a professor at U of A. So those relationships have been really invaluable to me working on the journal.
All right, and then Mr. Ponder.
So, you know, in terms of the how interacting with the community, from a organization level, we try to do a lot of that, and we do it within the Hispanic community, we do it within the Native community, we do it within the African American community, and we have done programming or tried to do programming with each of those communities, and to sort of lift up AHS, but also to provide a value to the community. And I will tell you honestly that during my tenure here in Southern Arizona, from time to time, we've had members of those communities sit on the chapter boards who virtually always leave before the end of their terms. And they left before the end of their terms, and they told me, I'm not being represented here. No one's hearing my voice here. And in some cases, you know, being flat out insulted here. The chapter at one point did a fundraiser where one of the local tribes had agreed to donate $10,000 to this fundraiser at a dinner. At the dinner where it was going to be presented, the chapter leadership got up and made some insulting remarks about the Native community. And in mass, they got up and turned around and walked out the door, and I literally spent 10 years trying to repair that relationship. And so if chapters are not only populated well, but have a vision that is inclusive, honestly inclusive, then they're going to be, the chapter membership, the chapter board membership is going to be a select group that becomes incestuous. And it's going to be that body, and it's not going to be anywhere else. I can't tell you how many times I've had members of the Hispanic community come up to me and say, they're not doing anything that represents me or represents our community. And so that's why we have to go outside of that to say, all right, let's talk about it. How can we join forces and do programming, do projects, and support each other? So there you go.
Thank you, Bill. Janice, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say, too, when they're talking about partnerships, not just from the staff but from the board, when we had the 100 Years, 100 Ranchers exhibit, I belong to the Arizona Cattle Growers, and Lynn Marcus, who was on the board at the time, belongs to one of the preservation areas out in Scottsdale, and we invited Connie Englehorn, another cattle grower member, and we went, when we had the exhibits, we wanted a panel of women ranchers and men ranchers. We went to the organizations that we were affiliated with. We sent notices out. We put articles in Arizona Catalog. And all of us on the board belong to groups like that that we can help bring in when we're doing certain exhibits and let them know more about the Arizona Historical.
Thank you, Janice. And I don't want to leave Flagstaff out. There is a very good example there, and that is Flagstaff's Flagstaff's Resilient Women Past and Present. That was a partnership with 21 voices in the community, and I'm not quite sure how to put a punctuation mark on this conversation, but I think it's important what we've heard from the polyphonic voices on the staff. And, you know, Bill, unfortunately, I have to echo what I'm hearing from you. Now, that is not consistent across the state. It is a pernicious problem in some areas more than others, and I hear it a lot specifically in Southern, to be honest. I have spent the last 2.5 years turning around ugly, ugly relationships with people, quite frankly, that the Southern Chapter Board royally offended. And I think the work that I've done here that I'm most proud of in this 2.5 years is turning around those relationships.
And I think the other thing that is underscored here, what I'm hearing is staff, if they can't get the support they need or want, or that's even available in the chapter board, they have to go outside the chapter board to get the kind of support they're looking for.
I think it's even a little bit more than that, Linda. It's just about sheer numbers. Like when we're talking about these are little examples, but what has informally we've come to call community voices, they number into the hundreds, and they represent the collective networks of the staff, which is very diverse, and so thus we have contacts in many different communities. They're interested in having a voice in the institution. They're not interested in a vote. They don't want to be formally organized. They want to be heard. They want what Bill was talking about with the Native community that gave the donation and then turned around and got insulted.
One comment I may have, I serve on the city council here in our little tiny town, and one of the things, if you sign on to the council, you're given an assignment to sit on, like, for example, sit on the Chamber of Commerce board. I sit on a few other boards as the council representative to that board. And so I'm able to be the council's eyes and ears on what's going on in that organization. And it's very different if you look at the relationship we have now where you have chapter representatives sitting on the board. Their allegiance is not to the Arizona Historical Society. I mean, I'm not disparaging it. I'm just saying they are a member of that chapter who sits on the board as opposed to being a member of the board who sits on that chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And it automatically brings, you know, for example, I really think, no matter what we do, I really think that Michael and Tom, whatever you write, one of the things that needs to happen is to have somebody from the board sitting on the chapter, not necessarily the other way around. Somebody who's a more of a neutral person, you know, somebody who's not a Tucson guy trying to represent Tucson to the board, but rather a board, you know, a guy like me, for example. I'm willing to go down and sit on the Tucson board meeting once a month or whatever, and if they shut me out, I'll come back and report to the board. Hey, they don't want our presence. I recommend that we revoke their charter. I mean, I would do that.
I think one of the problems has been, in terms of achieving unity, is the idea that, and this has been slow among the staff as well, is the idea that we are statewide and not married to one location or another. And it is, the bottom line is, you're going to serve on this board. If you are going to serve on this board, you're going to have to be able to think statewide. Okay? That is our mission, to allocate statewide. And we will gather, we already gather input from lots of different areas. But the ability is to step outside the regionalism and have an understanding of where we are as a state entity.
I would add something, if possible, on that, and that is I think you have to think both statewide and regional. And what I mean by that is you'll see some boards of directors or even department meetings in organizations where the big push is don't be parochial. Just think of this larger picture. And what happens is they wind up losing the special diverse expertise that they have, and they're going to try to kind of, everything's going to be homogenized into this one state view or this organizational view. And so you'll have someone, and I saw an example recently cited where an HR director was sitting on this one committee in this large organization, and the HR director was reluctant to bring up special HR concerns because the person was supposed to be thinking about the larger picture, and as a result, nobody heard about the special HR concerns. And so what you need is both and. You need people who are, they're going to be thinking about a larger organization, but they're also going to bring in a particular perspective that we may not have, the rest of us may not possess. And I think that's one of those balances that you're looking for, and sometimes it's going to tilt one way, sometimes it will tilt the other. I've noticed on this particular board, I really have not noticed since you've had the chapter representatives on the board, a great deal of parochialism on the part of the chapters. I think that people have actually been speaking more as board members.
I can think of some exceptions there, Michael, but we don't have to go into that. Yes, Tom.
I would just have a question for the board, and that is, as you listen to the examples that the staff gave of community voices, relationship building that's been going on here in this organization for the last few years, that, from my perspective, fulfills the need that we have in terms of that voice from our respective communities and various cultures. So my question is, so what purpose do the chapters serve beyond that? And I will tell you that from the community voices experiences that I've had, those individuals do not want to be encumbered by the structure of a board, like a commitment, the bylaws, the all of that stuff. They don't want that. What they want is for their voice to be heard. So that's, I just throw that out there because of the experiences that I've had, and I know some of my colleagues have had.
If I can just respond to that, I think that we're talking about two different boxes. You're going to, naturally, we would expect the staff to be reaching out into the community, making contacts, to put on particular events or exhibits. That is just part of being a good professional staff. One thing I'd also note, though, is, we're hearing kind of the staff bash the chapters today.
No.
And that's what I'm hearing. And we're not hearing the chapters side of the story necessarily. And often you get that at meetings where it's just a case of, well, staff, this chapter messed up here, they were rude there, et cetera, et cetera. And so I realize that you may say, well, that's not intended, but that can come through that way.
Michael, sorry to interrupt, but I don't want to go down that road staff versus chapters and that kind of thing.
Well, I know that, but I think we've had several examples of this chapter messed this up and they did that. And, if you go to chapters, it's important to move them away from this staff member didn't do this right or this person didn't treat me right.
And Michael, let me reassure you that the one outstanding chapter here has been approached, and you can't just meet with yourself, okay?
Mm-hmm.
There has to be an agreement there to meet. And so let's just leave it at that. The other thing is, let me pose something else to you. Staff has brought up this where they give examples where they have reached out statewide. They have far reached to get input for a variety of things. My question is, how can 8 or 10 people on a chapter adequately represent the wants and needs of a region that may have 400,000-500,000 people in a catchment area?
In the same way that the members of this board can represent them.
Well, but that hasn't been done. Tom, you there, Tom? Hello. Tom,
yeah.
Is it practical for a chapter board that has 10 people or less or 10 people or more to adequately connect with a metropolitan area that has over 500,000 people. But how do you go about doing that? And how would you attempt to do that?
Which Tom?
Tom Rose.
When we're discussing the board of directors of your chapters, they're elected out of the membership of Arizona Historical Society, and they can only represent a very small number. When you start looking at membership numbers of 500,000, a population area of 500,000 that has 0.01% of that population as members of the Historical Society, no, you don't get adequate representation. But you do get a representation of the people that are in a membership and care about the society. When you break that down to a smaller locale, 60,000 people, and you have 25 members and about 14% of the populace as members, you have a lot better chance of representing the public. It's the same as if you want to go there, elections. And elections, legislators are characteristically elected by about less than 30% of the population of the. So you have to look at the number of people that are interested in what you're doing and how you can get there. It's the board chapter members and the boards of directors that are responsible in their areas to go out into the public and let it be known that they do exist and we like to have their support. When you look at, I'm just going to recommend on our Northern Division, go sector, the board of directors is continually working with people in the public to notify them that we are there and that we need their assistance. And we do generate quite a bit of assistance. It's all boils down to the activity of your membership, the involvement in what's going on. Northern's been quite fortunate, as well as in Yuma, having memberships that go out into the community and work. I don't know if this is answering any of your questions, but my opinion is in the duties in the board of directors of the chapters, we need to be looking at stimulating people, asking what needs to be done to help. I know up here on our outreach for several of our programs where we put programs into Murdoch Center, the city public library, Northern Arizona University, we had quite a bit of involvement of membership in assisting staff to move those items because we didn't have enough staff to man the buildings and do the moves at the same time. So,
Tom, your point is well taken. I think at this point we've chewed on this
point
where we can't go much farther as a large group. I want to see what comes out of Michael Wade's committee. And Michael Wade, would you have something for us to look at? I mean, when do you expect that to happen? We are going to have to, we'll talk later, we'll talk offline about the meeting schedule and the conflicts therein, and work something out. But when do you think you're going to come up with something?
We have a meeting coming up on, I believe it's January 27th.
Yes, and yes. We'll talk about that later because that's in conflict with a meeting that's longstanding for the executive committee. So, So.
No, I mean, it can, we can be, governance people can go ahead and meet and then present it to the executive committee.
Which would mean you would have to meet in the morning.
Yes.
Because, right? I mean, ours starts at what time, James?
Noon.
That's at noon.
Yeah.
Ours is at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Okay. All right. Sounds good to me. Okay. Let's move on.
Thing before you move on, I hope that whatever we do, let's try and understand what the Auditor General was seeing and saying and make sure we respond to what the Auditor General did on their adverse comments.
And we should get feedback on that. They have a copy of the latest rolls that were approved on in 2019. But maybe subject to change here. Okay, committee reports. We have some important ones coming up, not the least of which is Properties and Building Committee. And Tom, I know that you've had you have met, and I know that Eric has accomplished some masterful things in his own right, and that we had a tour recently that included both Denise and Sharon on their first sort of facilities level tour of the museum in Tucson. So would you go ahead and start the report, Tom, and we'll have others weigh in.
Okay. To start with, I'm just going to give you a quick overview of the work that has been going on. Eric's done a marvelous job interfacing with ADOA and prompting them to fund several projects that are really important in our operations. Right now, Sanguinetti's got a house that's working on replacement of a roof and planning for new bathrooms. The roof plan is under review by ADOA. The historic Arizona History Museum in Tucson is rekeying. Eric's got a bid for adding surveillance cameras to all of the museums. It's turning out to be about $6,800 per, and there's not funds available on the general budget. I would suggest if it's available, if James can verify, 1107 funds can be provided for that use. That's improving a facility or protecting exhibits. 1107 funds should be able to use to fund that camera installation. That's just one proposal, and that would be killing two birds with one stone, getting rid of the surplus 1107s and fixing a surveillance and security issue. The Brown House lease has been renewed with the user down there. Sosa Korea has two leases renewed to users there. When you look at the History Center in Tempe, ADOA has approved HVAC and lighting programs, and POs have been issued for some of those, or for both of those. The green line drain is still a major problem. Its location and expense is one of the biggest ones. And when it comes to Pioneer, all the barn electrical upgrades have been completed and approved by ADOA. That was done in late November, early November, by the department. And ADOA has approved wood preservation application, all of the materials provided by Northern Arizona Pioneer Historical Society, and as well has approved the funding to
upgrade the electrical in the museum. All of these are pending SHPO approvals. That's one of the steps that we're going through, and Eric's been doing a marvelous job dealing with that. I'm just glad he has to do it, not me.
Tom, could I interject for just 1 minute? I want to say a special thanks to you and your committee for recognizing what an amazing job Eric has done, but also B, for working so well as a staff and board team. That's how we've gotten here. Thank you.
Well, that's our intent. And I would like to thank my other two board members. My memory for names is really bad, so. And I can see one here.
Denise and
Shan. We're really happy to be seeing ADUA step up and providing funds for some of these projects that have been just a miserable thorn in our side.
Eric, can you just weigh in briefly and congratulations? We were told that you have been awarded about $1 million worth of approval.
Yeah.
To get this stuff done. Is that right, Eric?
The CAP had so many backlogged items that it was, you know, the dam was ready to break. That's what happened here is, really made such a massive noise there with ADOA and my strategy is you get the foot in the door and you open the door wide open, and that's what I've been trying to do. So, in particular, the $550,000 project to replace the chiller at the Arizona Heritage Center in Tempe was of that caliber. They went to look at a $30,000 replacement of a chiller control panel, and I was able to get it into the building when I had everybody I wanted there. I let them know and showed them, with the help of Jan Brzezinski's, how terrible that chiller was, and that basically putting the new control panel on this chiller was just putting a Band-Aid on a problem that was not going to go away. And so once they saw that with their own eyes, they said, yeah, we need to replace this. This is in really bad shape. And so once we got them on board, they were very creative in assisting us, and there just coincidentally was some energy efficiency dollars that they were able to allocate to our agency to get that project in the works. And so that project is very far down the road. It's already been fabricated. It's being shipped into pieces to the Heritage Center, where it's being stored until they can give us the final installation date, which we know from an email earlier today that will be for sure in February. So this is great news. I'm going to start to hear complaints that it's too cold in the building now. So I'm going to make that.
Well, congratulations. Eric, I think this is the beginning of maybe a whole new way of engaging the powers that be that control some of these things. It's been at a stalemate way too long, and you
deserve
all kinds of credit. Let me go just to Denise, perhaps, who can summarize what she saw during her her tour with Eric. What did you see there? And tell us about the experience.
Well, I guess I'll start out at the main museum there in Tucson. That was very interesting, and found a lot of the projects that were going on. They also presented a lot of problems, and I was really overwhelmed by the collections that they had in storage there. I know that here in Douglas, at our Douglas Historical Museum, we also have a big storage problem, nothing compared to what they had there in Tucson. and we'd like to work with that. I guess my whole thing is that it's just, I've just realized, I don't want to call it the power, but I'll call it the power that we have by being a state property, and apparently we didn't know that before, like last year. So we've been handling a lot of the things on our own and trying to figure out what to do, but due to Cindy, Payostic, she brought the fact that, you know, we are a state property, they should get some more more conversations going on with things that are going down at the Douglas Williams house. The other thing that, the other place we went to was the Sosa Carrillo Fremont house, and my background has mostly been in, like, landscape-type things with historical sites, and I saw that there's going to be some problems there that are going to be critical in the future. Number one, you have a treed parking lot. I know that trees grow. Eventually something's going to happen with those maybe, and next thing you know, they want to take down all the trees, and I don't know what effect that's going to have on the rest of it. So I was checking into whether although I worked with the National Park Service, we looked at the professionals and that dealt with landscape art. You know, landscape architecture and things like that, especially from the historical point of view. I do have some concerns for the property there, especially there seems to be a lack of cooperation with the city of Tucson and us, the state. It might be an understatement, but that was obvious in that. And it really came to light when we tried to just walk over to the Charles Brown house, and we couldn't because they had their construction things up there, and Eric kept making a point about how when all of this, when he started working with the Historical Society, you can still see the mountains around the area there. And you couldn't see a thing there. All you could see was the buildings, what was going on. And so you have this, I also went through the National Register documents that were online for that house and found, I guess back in the 70s, they called it urban renewal. That's not something I would have called urban renewal. To me, that's just urbanization. Things that were not taken into account, and I wondered what the planning situation was with the city of Tucson. So then when we went from there to the Charles Brown house, Charles Brown property, I guess, where they house the Ben Bell site or a studio, and that was interesting. I was just kind of concerned that I never saw any mention that, you know, the property they were on belonged to the state. I mean, it was all them, and that's the people. I mean, it's a great nonprofit and what things they're doing, and they have several locations throughout the nation, but I thought that, you know, they should be aware of it somewhere, and, you know, even on their website, there was no mention of, you know, with the state coordination and where they were. So those are some of my first impressions. Oh, at the museum, I did appreciate the fact that they had, a children's section there, because I felt they were the future, and they might be the way that we carry on our mission and everything in the, you know, 20, 40 years from now. And was also concerned that we have frequent complaints that, or statements or observations that the, nobody comes there. And I kept wondering why. And also, the venue that was there that seemed to be underused. And I know we'll be having problems now, but even before, you know, it's a great room to be used, especially for small organizations or for people to have things. And I always mention that, remember that Dr. Burns keeps bringing up the fact that we get a lot of our revenue from when people have events there at our facilities. So I was basically looking into some of that and some opportunities that may also present themselves around the other sites around the state. So.
Thank you, and thank you for sharing your experiences on behalf of Sharon. We'll likely come back to this because I see this. This committee is no longer a backwater. It's no longer an afterthought. It's going to be front and center. Next, Janice, do you have anything from the Community Outreach Committee?
Yes, I do. The certification application program for both renewals and new certification was opened in December, and applications will be open until the end of January. We have incorporated a one-page renewal form for historical institutions
that are currently certified instead of filling out the whole 4 or 5 page thing. And it will be a lot easier for them to do and easier for our committee to renew and approve. But we do have one exception, and if you were previously certified but didn't do it last year, then you will have to fill the whole shebang out. And the staff have sent emails to historical institutions and museums around the state that are not now or have never been certified, inviting them to join. And they are going to have a Zoom meeting on January 13th at 1 p.m. to provide an interview of the program and answer any questions they might have. And our committee will be meeting on February 16th to review and approve the renewal and to review the new applications for certification. And for the new board members, the new applications that have never been certified before, we are going to send recommendations at the next board meeting so the board can see what new certification museums that we have. And that's it.
Excellent. Any questions for Janice? Sounds like it's busy and productive. Okay. Michael Wade, Governance Committee report. The brand new chairman of that committee. Take it away.
And I'm following in the steps of John Lacey, and those are very big shoes indeed. And we lost a lot of institutional memory when John Lacey left. We have a great committee, Bruce Gwynn, Tom Rose, Richard Shaw, and, Bruce and Tom are on the board. Richard Shaw, for those of you who are relatively new to the board, served on the board for a number of years. Who knows, he may be returning, but he was president of the society at one point. Very, very bright guy. Well, we're going to be talking about items related to the chapter roles. We're going to be looking over getting rid of the membership committee. And I remember it was quite a while back that you had a membership committee that voted to self-destruct. But somehow, that thing kind of puttered along. The date of the annual meeting needs to be changed. Tom Rose is working on inconsistencies between policies and bylaws. We've noticed there may have been some policies that have been passed, but they were not written and into the policy manual. So we're looking to catch that. And then Kelly Corsett has a group, and they're going to be providing a draft document on a bylaws change related to the elections. And so if anybody on the board has ideas for the governance committee, let us know. Get in touch with me, because we're going to be booking meetings and trying to get this stuff moving along in an expedited fashion.
Love it. Thank you, Michael. Any questions for Michael? Anything? All right. Let's go on to announcements. I have none, but does anybody here, for the good of the order, want to say something or announce something? Nobody? Okay. I'm going to declare this meeting over, adjourned, and our next board meeting is scheduled for February 19th. We just know, executive committee members, we're going to be adjusting the schedule a little bit to accommodate so that we hear from finance and governance and other committees ahead of time. So stay tuned. We'll work something out. But it doesn't sound like we have a conflict for the 27th. You meet early. We're meeting a little bit later. Sounds good to me. Okay. Then I'm going to say farewell to you all, and thank you to the staff. It's a new year, and we're going to get a lot done. Okay, thank you all. See you.
Linda,
yes.
Could I touch?